Hello, this is Peter Jacoby for Profiles, with a guest who, in just 7 years, has gained the deep devotion of her students and highest respect from her colleagues and audiences. Mezzo-soprano Marianne Hart not only teaches in the voice department of Indiana University's Jacobs School of Music, but is its chair, and she also offers her lofty level of artistry to area audiences and concerts that prove here's a teacher who fully practices what she preaches, singing with a sense for style that no matter what the material, honors and enriches it. Welcome, Marianne.
Thanks, Peter.
Let's do some background first. Let's trace how you got here, as is the case with all faculty in the performing arts area of the School of Music. You've got professional credentials.
Mm-hmm.
Can we find out about them?
Well, right before I came to IU, I'd spent 19 years in New York being a freelance singer. So you offer me money and I would sing. And I did all kinds of singing in New York. I did some early music. I had done more early music before New York. I'd been in Vienna for 3 years. And there I had been involved with sort of an early music crowd with Edward Melkus, who was a colleague of Harnoncourt. And I had taken seminars with their teacher, Josef Mertin. Well, I didn't actually take the seminars. I just showed up and we would sing. And so I did some early music when I first got to New York. And I sang for whoever would hear me and did quite a bit of oratorio, and my first love has always been song singing. So I was trying to do all the song competitions I could find, because that way I thought people would hear me singing songs and maybe something would happen from that. And it was just fun to do the research to get the programs together for all the competitions. And I did some only strange opera, Philip Glass opera, not the mainstream.
Well, you toured with one Philip Glass.
I toured with Hydrogen Jukebox, which was his collaboration with Allen Ginsberg. So I never imagined myself on the stage holding hands with Allen Ginsberg, but there I was. And I did the revival of Einstein on the Beach at BAM, Brooklyn Academy of Music. So those were not traditional operatic experiences, but that had never been my first love. But it interested me musically. And so that's why I did that.
And you were able to keep yourself financially going?
More or less. There were some slim pickings some years, but I also taught. I had sort of a motley crew private studio, and then I taught for 7 years part-time at Vassar, so I'd commute up to Poughkeepsie and teach up there.
Yes, I saw that you had Vassar in your credentials and the Manus School.
Yeah, Manus, I did a couple of seminars. Well, not seminars. What they would call them? I don't know, classes. One was oratorio rep, was basically a performance class. And the other, the kids asked for, was American song rep. And so that was fun.
But basically, it was all sort of together.
Piecemeal, huh? Yeah, put together by myself.
Had you become tired of this, and this is what led you then to Indiana?
Or? No, it was all about real estate, actually. Well, you know, as a singer, you get to be a certain age, and there's a new generation coming up, and, you know, the performing starts to dwindle down. And I was already doing quite a lot of teaching, and I thought, well, I should get a real salary for this. And so I'd been watching the listings in one of the listservs, and when I saw the ad for IU, I thought, well, that's an opera school. They will have no need of me, because that was never my thing. Well, little did I know that they were looking for someone to teach song literature, and that was not in the job description, but turned out just fine. I mean, that was what I do. So, to my surprise, and I like Bloomington. It's the right size, and the students are fabulous. So
you're happy.
Yeah, I am.
From what I've learned, you're a natural at this. But how did you view the change?
From New York to Bloomington?
And from, you know, being primarily a professional singer to being primarily a teacher.
Well, it wasn't all that hard, to tell you the truth. I mean, it's all about music. whether I'm doing it myself or teaching it, it's what I do. So, I mean, I'd never taught an actual academic class on song before, and that took a lot of work because, I mean, I knew a lot, but I'd never put it together in any kind of intelligible manner or within a syllabus and to play examples and all of that. I mean, I had ideas, but that was a lot of work. But it was, you know, I've probably learned as much or more than the students have, you know, putting it all together. And I've sung a lot here. One of the things I love to do is chamber music, and you can't afford to do it in New York. If you're lucky enough to find a gig doing some chamber music, that's great, but it's too expensive to pay players. And here are all these fabulous musicians. So that's been a lot of fun.
Now, the song literature, this is a huge field.
Yeah.
How do you approach putting a course together?
Well, it had always been done sort of by period, and I just did that. And so one's sort of before 18 or before 1750, then early Romantic, late Romantic, 20th century. And it's sort of whatever I want. And the repertoire is vast. So I try to put in clearly Schubert. You know, what are you going to give Schubert 2 weeks? You could give him two semesters. So I try to pick out some things that are good for pedagogical purposes that they could use to teach students, and some for the, you know, for the mature performer. So I get a little bit of both angles, things that the students could sing themselves on doctoral recitals, and then weird repertoire. I mean, I do like a lot of strange, out-of-the-way pieces that they probably have not encountered. So it's fun introducing that to them.
And which you like to sing from time to time.
I do.
Because I've heard you do some unusual things. Yeah. Now, you have a studio also. Mm-hmm. How many
now
students?
Since my duties as chair take up part of my load, I only have about a half a dozen students. So it's a little hard to get into the swing of teaching with so few, and they're sort of scattered among the days. But I still enjoy that. That's another different kind of work, too, figuring out how voices work. And that's fun, too.
Now, one of your students recently got the Metropolitan Opera National
Auditions.
Yeah,
Jamie Barton won the National Auditions. That was very exciting.
It must have been a special.
Oh, yes, I made a loud noise when they called her name.
But what more generally speaking do you gain from teaching students?
Well, I've learned a lot about my own technique. Having to, you know, identify other people's problems that are different than my own. And to see people grow artistically is very rewarding. And to see them start loving the repertoire that you love. And some idea that, you know, will carry on with this sort of elitist little corner of music, that it does feed the soul and that that'll get passed on. It's kind of corny, but it's true.
Well, you see yourself going on through the students, I suspect.
Yeah.
And yet at the same time, you want to make sure that they don't copy you, that they retain their individuality.
I like a lot of people, I retain a few pieces that are just mine.
Do most of the students in your studio, and you've had more when you weren't the chair of the mm-hmm. department, do they tend to want to specialize in song literature, too? I know Jamie, of mm-hmm. course, is an opera singer.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm. It just depends on the student. You know, I like students. It's hard to, you know, choosing students, you don't really know them very well when you get them. Sometimes I love that spark of imagination or curiosity. And to me, that's, in terms of having fun in teaching, it's almost more crucial than the voice. There are lots and lots of beautiful voices out there, but the ones that have that little bit of imagination and, like I said, curiosity, that's fun for me as a teacher.
Would you take us into your studio and share with us how a lesson might unfold?
Mm-hmm.
And I know each one would be different.
But right, right. Usually I greet the student, see if they're healthy. That's sort of the first thing. Are you going to be able to make a sound? And do they look tired or excited or something like that? And then we warm up a little bit. and just getting their voice to work, starting in the middle, moving out to the ends. And I have some Xerox pages of exercises that I've collected from my various teachers or colleagues along the way. And depending on the student, I'll pick some of those. And then after they get to some point that sounds halfway warmed up, we'll start working on music. I don't teach technique totally through repertoire, but repertoire has always been the deal for me. It's like we're here to sing songs and or arias, whichever. So then I try to pick repertoire that not only fits their voice but their personality. Sometimes you challenge them a little bit. Like my teachers challenged me. I would like typical mezzo. I'd like slow and minor keys and heartfelt ballads, that kind of thing. So you try to find something that will energize that one. And I had another student who was a coloratura who came to my studio quite accomplished already. And I said, now, if you're going to be in the studio, you have to learn how to sing slow. And she sort of took her aback, but I'd thrown down the gauntlet. And that opened up this whole other part of her personality. Because her voice did this fancy thing so easily, she'd never really tried to step back and do the slow, spinny thing. So that was fun, you know, as an example.
I sat in on some master classes when Virginia Ozzeani was still on the faculty.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed to me that when no matter what the students brought in to sing there, she knew mm-hmm. the literature. And you apparently know the literature. I mean, you teach literature of song. How do you gain this? How have you?
Well, I don't know the operatic literature as well as the song literature, but most students are starting out with smaller forms anyway, or well-known, not-so-difficult arias. I suppose the hardest thing is when it's not your voice type and you've never sung, you know, things that are specifically for tenors or baritones or even for sopranos. But I've gone to millions of concerts and I've had friends in all these various voice parts. Sometimes I'll ask friends, you know, what did you enjoy singing? What did you use for auditions when you were 19? You know, just to get some more ideas. And I've judged, and I've heard now about a million auditions here. Yeah. We heard like 500 screening tapes last year. And so, you know, you hear a lot of music. And so
you must have a good memory, too, at least to recall it.
It's always nice. Sometimes you'll forget about a piece, and all of a sudden, there it is, and it's, you know, it's great all over again.
Well, I want to spend a little time listening to you mm-hmm. or having our listeners listen to you. And I know that Charles Ives, is one of your specialties and one of your favorites.
Mm-hmm.
You have selected a piece called Things Our Fathers Loved.
Mm-hmm.
Could you tell us a little bit about it before we listen in?
Well, that's kind of a nice one to start with because he uses quotes from a lot of different popular songs. You'll hear in the very first three notes, I think there must be a place in the soul. I wish I was in the land of cotton, just for example. And you'll hear hymn tunes and various things, at least still for my generation, are familiar sort of common denominator American songs. When I went to graduate school in 1776, the bicentennial was my last year of grad school. So American music was everywhere. That's what everyone was performing. It was a huge deal. And so someone had asked me to do a little concert, a private concert, out in the countryside of Illinois. And so they invited friends from these very small towns. And I did a group of Ives on that concert, including this. And I had looked up in some dissertation, or this is long before I knew Peter Burkholder, all the quotes that were in that song. And I thought, oh, how cool that was. So I told them.
Identify him as a real specialist on Ives.
Right, yeah.
Officer of the Ives Society,
right,
and so on.
Right, Mr. Ives. Yes. So I made a list of all these folk songs that were quoted, and I sang it, and then I said, listed this, and I asked them if they would tell me which songs they heard. And I think this audience, and of course they were mostly about a generation older than me, got every single one. Mm-hmm. And I was astonished. And it was, I'll never forget that moment because it was something they never would have heard before. But yet it resonated with them in this very American place.
Well, let's listen to Charles Ives, Marianne Hart, Things Our Fathers Loved.
I think there must be a place in the soul, all made of tunes of long ago. I hear the organ on the main street corner, and
we've just heard Marianne Hart, our guest on this Profiles, sing Charles Ives' Things Our Fathers Loved. Now, could you take us into your mind and into your practice room? How do you prepare a song like this?
Mm-hmm. Well, there's the getting it into the voice part. And for that, I use all kinds of singerly tricks, which may sound really strange to non-singers. Besides just learning the notes, plunking the notes out on the piano, there are the words, and the words are very important to me. The text is, it's very important. But you have to have the line of the voice, the legato line, the connected line of the voice. So I generally sing songs on just the vowels with no consonants. So and so that I really know exactly how my tongue and lips are articulating all those vowels, shaping the vowels so that they're very discreet and clear. Then when I add the consonants back in, I have so much more line than I would even if I were really working on pronouncing the words. I have more of a singing line. And it's all clearer. I worked for a while.
At the same time, the diction would be.
The diction is much,
clearer.
Much better because, you know, e, I, o, u, that's all fine and good, but you also have to sound beautiful on u and I and strange medial vowels. I worked in Vienna with an American voice teacher who was, his big interest was the acoustics of vowels in the voice. So if you thump on your neck, you can probably hear those vowels across the room. I'm just thumping on my throat, making those vowels. So our practice was working on vowel modification in this very, very specific way. You don't even know how much I'm doing it, but it comes out, everything is clear and beautiful. So that's a big part of it. Figuring out, you know, looking at the dynamics and then finding sort of a shape for the piece. Where am I going with the piece? And then as I work on the piece, it becomes different. I become more specific, have an image in my mind of where I am, why I'm singing it, time of day, all of those things. And that's not fixed. It can change depending on what mood I'm in. And you start hearing different things. And then, of course, it's a collaborative effort, you know, singing songs. You heard Dennis Helmrich on that recording, and we worked together for most of the time that I was in New York. And, you know, we're both different, and I think better musicians for working with each other. I had the opportunity to work with Leonard Hokanson just a couple of times before he died. And it was so interesting because he loved inner voices. And I'd be singing along, and then I would hear something I'd never noticed before, like, what the heck is that? I mean, a little distracting, but he was just satisfying his own interest in the inner voices of pieces. So, I mean, that's an enormous pleasure to me, the collaborative part. I like rehearsing. It's not that someone has to teach me the notes, but to learn from each other, like doing French music with Jean-Louis Hagenauer. You know, first of all, he doesn't laugh when I sing in French. And then, you know, he brings a whole different cultural perspective to this repertoire. And so it's illumining.
So do you, as I gather, you think about the musical aspects first and then the content, the subject matter, or does it come together?
Well, I mean, I know all these books say, oh, memorize the poem before you start on the song. I don't think I ever do that. I do pick songs based on whether I'm attracted to the poetry sometimes. I mean, some songs are just beautiful. But to me, there almost has to be a relationship with the text there that's evokes something, a response in me. But like I say, that kind of evolves, too, as I'm working on the piece.
And I suppose as you continue to sing something, keep it in your repertory, there are dramatic changes.
There are the poetic, the things that the poet does to make a poem. Like, take the very famous poem, Über allen Gipfeln ist Ruhe. This is Goethe. Over all the treetops is peace. And there are areas in the song that are all about U vowels. Über allen Gipfeln ist Ruhe, in allen Wipfeln spürest du kaum einen Hauch. And kaum einen Hauch is scarcely a breath. And you hear the Hauch, it's onomatopoeia, you know, and it's built in for you to make a color. And sometimes if you then identify, well, this is sort of an ah area, this is an oo area, you know, your voice takes on color. That's how you make, one of the ways you make color. It's not by manipulating your sound, you know, that can be dangerous, I think. Or look at Irving Berlin. Mm-hmm. What'll I do when you are far away and I am blue? What'll I do? I mean, it's the best oo vowel exercise, you know, anywhere.
I hate to stop your singing. We could stop the conversation and listen. It's terrific. Let's go back to another piece of music for us to listen to. But rather than something that you have sung, something that you enjoy, you must have favorite composers in addition to Mr. Ives. Mm-hmm. Who are some? And then let's...
And why?
And why?
Well, it depends on the day. In terms of leader, I love Wolf because he's all about the words and he's very vivid. Schubert, you have to love Schubert.
Such wonderful recordings. Do you have some favorite other singers?
Oh, gosh. Current singers, former singers. Well, I like, there's one singer, not Schubert so much, Irma Colasi, who has a very old-fashioned sound. I don't know that people would like it so much anymore. But she sings with enormous humanity. Mm-hmm. And she sings, Forêt, La Chanson d'Ève, and it's great. I love Hugues Queneau, who's now 104, I think, or something like that. He has a recording of Eric Satie, Socrate, which is, there's a three movements and the death of Socrates. When he sings that, I can weep. His French is so beautifully formed that you think you're fluent just the way you listen to it. And he makes that very simple music just full of pathos, and I love that.
We're going to try a piece of instrumental music, and I think you mentioned that you like Janáček.
Yeah, I brought this Janáček piece because There's also something about his music. I think it's because he notated sounds that he heard in nature and around. He notated the inflection of people as they spoke or sang. So I think it's not sort of superimposing words on a tune that already just occurred to you, the beautiful formed tune. But it all sounds kind of conversational and full of color. And I really enjoy that for that reason. It's a word reason, too.
You also bridge styles. You find modernism, you find neoclassicism, you find impressionism, you find nativism.
I saw, when I lived in Vienna, I saw Yanufa, such a soap opera. Of course, I was just dissolved in tears. But it's also because, you know, the music sounds like what it is. It sounds like all of these emotions. So Verdi could write these fabulous melodies, but there's something about the Janáček that seems very spontaneous to me.
Well, what have you chosen by Mr. Janáček?
This is a violin sonata, the second movement. And I can't even say that I know it all that well. It's just something that appeals to me. So.
Okay. Do you know the
Christian
artist?
Christian Tetzlaff. Okay. And I'm sorry, I don't remember the pianist.
All right. Let's listen to which movement?
Second movement.
The second movement of the Janáček Violin Sonata. We have just heard one of Marianne Hart's favorite instrumental pieces by a composer favorite, Leos Janáček, second movement of his violin sonata. Let's go back to singing and to your students. Are they talented?
Yeah.
Is talent increasing?
I don't know that I have enough. I don't know how to answer that.
It's just, you know, when I look at the instrumental field, the pianists, the violinists, and so forth, the numbers of who are out there with great talent, and the chamber groups. You know, when I was growing up and younger, there were three or four chamber string quartets that you heard about.
Mm-hmm.
Today there are 50.
There are a ton of talented singers out there, and not enough work to support everyone. I mean, this is an old saw, and it's true. And people, I always tell my students that they have to do it for the music. You know, if they're not getting a reward from the music, there's something else they could make a lot more money doing with a lot less grief. But, you know, there's this compulsion to sing is very, very strong. And you sort of have to indulge it or you'll be unhappy for not having tried to do it. So, and I think that they learn a lot about themselves. We all do. I mean, to me, singing is... working on music is therapy. You know, you come up against a problem and you have to kind of work through it. And what satisfies you artistically? I mean, if you're thinking about it, it might just be all about your voice. I think for some people with, you know, glorious voices, capital G, capital B, maybe that's enough. You know, I don't know.
You haven't been here long enough to trace the future of a lot of students, but are they beginning to move into the profession, those that you've had?
Yeah, I mean, this month in Opera News, there was a review of Figaro production in Boston, and the Susanna, the Carabino, and I'm not positive, I think the Count, were all IU grads.
Hmm.
Yeah. So you do see them moving into the world and finding a place or finding a balance of things to do. And I tell them, you know, the press can only cover about the top, you know, 0.5% of all the working singers out there. And there are a lot of people out there doing honorable work all over the place and some very fine work, but you just don't hear about it. So, you know, it's hard for them to form an opinion because they haven't seen any further than the reviews of the very most famous people. And it remains to be seen what balance they all find, you know, what they want to do.
But they all learn something that they can apply no matter what
they end up doing. Yeah, it's always, I mean,
doing.
IU is just the beginning, and the great ones keep on learning all the time. All the time. And they just don't stop. At least, I think for a really long time, people still learn roles. You know, Carol Vanest did the Marshalin for the first time last year. Come on, you know. You're learning.
It was 47 years ago that I interviewed Lotta Lehmann, who was giving master classes at Northwestern. And I think she was one of the first to go into this area. Pierre Bernac was also.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I remember her saying that the students that she was hearing, technically speaking, were so much better than the ones from previous generations.
I think there is there's great technical proficiency sort of all around. When I went to Vienna, I thought I was working at the Hochschule für Musik, and I didn't think there were that many technically advanced students there as compared to the university that I had come from. Now you hear, I think back then you heard more of a difference in technique. You could identify a certain European sound more, and I think the difference is much less. Probably recordings, global travel, everyone going everywhere. The regional differences are not so pronounced anymore. And the level has kind of, expectations are high.
Well, she said that, technically they were wonderful. And she never in her master classes dealt with technique.
Mm-hmm.
And she says, I'm here for interpretive reasons. But she says the difference sometimes is, and she put her hand to her heart, she says, they have the technique, however, we had the heart. Now, how can you impress that upon a young singer? Is it innate or can it be added to?
Well, I keep going back to these two words, imagination and curiosity. There has to be that, whether it's about an opera role or about a song. And the students now, they have an eye on the business side. They know better than my generation did, how the business works, what the business takes. They think they know, anyway. And so there's a little less, relaxation time for exploration, maybe. I mean, I spend a lot of time just poring over music, listening to it, going to recitals. It was easier back then, I think. You know, it was not as expensive to go to school, so you didn't have to have a whole lot of jobs. And I could go to concerts. I didn't have to work at Walgreens or whatever. So that's more difficult now. People who want to find out things, though, still do. And there are students that just make it their business to investigate this, that, or the other. And you never know when they're going to be caught up in something. And then that one thing is so wonderful, then they have to find everything else by that composer or whatever. So
one of the things that has impressed me about you when I've listened to you, and from the very first time I heard you and you stepped upon the stage of our hall at Indiana University, is your intense involvement in the music.
Mm-hmm.
That it isn't just being vocally sung nicely, purely, mm-hmm. but that you are totally into it.
Well, I'm very picky about my repertoire. Not to say I don't make mistakes from time to time. There are pieces that I sing once and think, well, that's enough of that. But then, like I say, I pick things that feed me musically, psychologically, with the poems. So, or maybe just with the sound of the music. So I am very involved. And I enjoy, you can feel an audience come to you. It's very clear to me when I have them and when I don't. So, and that's one of the great satisfactions to me of performing. When I was, well, a long time ago, I sang a recital at small college, and I'd come back from Vienna. It was actually my undergrad alma mater. And I did, like, I was preparing for competition, so I did four different recital programs in that year. A student, a violin student, came up to me and said, you know, I felt terrible when I came here, you know, nobody would sit with me. And he was kind of a pocket protector kind of guy. And he says, you know, but I feel great now. And I thought, that's it. That's all I want. You know, that's, it touched him in some way. And it meant a lot to me. So it's worth it.
And it means a lot to somebody listening.
Mm-hmm.
Because I will sometimes come into a concert pretty grim and glum. But I hear something and then it lifts me
mm-hmm.
and keeps me going.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose that, in a way, it does that for you, too.
Yeah. Yeah. And when, then there's the part that's acting, when you'd really rather be at home watching CSI, you know, then you put yourself into that place and you can do it. But that's the being professional part of it.
Which is always a part of it, isn't
yeah.
it? Yeah. Want to have you sing once more for
mm-hmm.
us. And you've selected some cabaret material.
Yeah, this is from my my 50th birthday concert. I decided to have a preemptive strike before someone else could figure out something to do. So I informally called it Marianne the First 50 Years, or Marianne the Early Years. And it was a nice program. I had my teacher from Illinois, John Woostman, who introduced me to Lieder. He was the first person I met who was rabid about music.
Terrific.
And
yes.
So we did a group of Hugo Wolf. Then I did a piece I had commissioned from a friend, Tom Cipullo in New York. And then I brought another friend from New York, Jim Bossi, to play this cabaret. And we had done it in a slightly different form in New York for a benefit. And he had made these beautiful arrangements. So this is an arrangement of Skylark paired with Spring Is Here by Rodgers and Hart.
Once there was a thing called spring, when the world was writing verses like yours and mine. All the lads and girls as they sat at the
We have just heard a cabaret performance by our guest in the studio today, Marianne Hart. Where do you think classical music is going? Some people say that it's dying. Other people see great revival in certain spots.
Oh, I don't know that I see a revival. I think it's the business is getting so strange now with the internet. I mean, it's not like you even hear the same records being played on the radio all the time. I'm talking even pop music now, and now with satellite radio, you can choose. You know, you're not exposed to a variety. It's like you find one thing and that's all you have to listen to. And so I think that's it's very different and very strange. In one way, I think the internet kind of opens things up where you can Google things and search out and buy pieces of this and that. That's kind of cool, and sample things maybe before you buy. But that's also totally different. I think in terms of classical music, it's getting people to hear it for the first time. It's like the guy from Wales that just won on
the cell phone show.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Did you watch that on the iTunes? I mean, there was something incredibly appealing about that because you could tell he loved it, and Puccini can write a tune. And all these people who'd never heard it, rock, you know, of course he won, you know. So, I mean, sometimes people don't really know. And I've done these sort of outreach things, residencies, where you go to schools and music clubs and this and that and the other thing. And people are almost always pleasantly surprised that it's not horrible when they have an idea that it'll be. I think probably this going to concerts and sitting around in a seat, that's harder and harder to sell because people want a whole experience and probably some more informal settings would be good. Well, that would be fine. I mean, look at Schubertiades. They probably didn't dress up, you know, all that much. And making music in smaller venues. There are articles all over the place about chamber music going into clubs now. And, well, I've been to jazz clubs. And you sit at a table and you have your drink and your little food. And, you know, it's not terrible. You don't smoke. But, you know, I enjoy that. Like watching movies at Bears.
Well, it's comfortable.
And French fries.
Right. And it's comfortable and it's also
intimate.
Intimate, exactly.
And you don't have this image of having to be stuck in your seat necessarily. The problem, of course, is acoustic. You know, you can't do it on mic and you need the space.
Right. And the issue of crossovers. You can see the pro and con, the pro being, well, it's introducing people to music that they otherwise might
Well,
ignore.
I mean, come on. I mean, art song's an elitist form. First of all, poetry is elitist.
That's right.
And it takes some attention. So some people can pay attention and others just can't. But people are built differently. You can see it even in little children. Some of them are all dreamy and focused on whatever little thing they're doing, and others are just all over the place. And I think adults are like that too, to some degree.
What impact do you think that's going to have on your students when they go out in the years ahead?
Well, you know, the deal is to expose children to music and not have it be a weird big deal, that they just hear some, and so it's not totally strange. Children who've had, well, when we have students who come in, the ones who've had parents who had them take music lessons, not singing because they're children, but piano lessons, violin lessons, whatever, flute lessons, then they've had the experience of making music and the fun that that is and the reward that that is. They have some experience of that rather than coming to it totally cold or never being in a situation where they have to sit and listen a little bit. That doesn't happen so much all the time. So I think it's got to be up to the parents. And if the parents don't do it, the school a little bit, but it's tough.
Not a lot done in the school.
Yeah.
Does it suggest that the artists themselves are going to have to go out and do some of the educating?
Well, it's astonishing to me that we keep getting people who want to do this, tons of them. So somehow, somewhere, it's getting out there. I'm not sure quite how, always. But there are magnet schools, I guess, and we get students from these magnet schools, and then I think just the parents. So when I taught at Vassar, I only had in 7 years maybe 2 voice majors, and the rest were, you know, liberal arts of some description. But I viewed that as missionary work, you know, and they all developed some appreciation for singing and what it takes and just the beauty of it, even understanding it on what level they understood it. Beauty is beauty, so, and fun is fun.
We've just about run out of time, but I want to ask you, what sage piece of advice do you give your students as they progress toward a music career?
Generally, I tell them it's all about the music, that they have to love the music more than anything else, love the music more than the idea of being famous, because that's where the reward has to come from. It's probably not going to come in the form of money, but how lucky we are to do something that we love and to make money at all with that. So very few people have that opportunity to really do something they love that's beautiful for money. That's what I say. It's all about the music.
Well, when I've heard you sing, I know that in your mind it's all about the music. And I want to thank you for joining us in the studio today. We've just listened to Marianne Hart. I thank you for your insights. I thank you for your time. For me, it's been enlightening. I think it will be that for our listeners. The program is Profiles, and I am Peter Jacoby.
The program you just heard was recorded in August of 2007. The studio engineer and technical producer was Michael Paskash. Emily McCord was our research assistant. Copies of this or other programs can be obtained by calling 812-855-1357. More information about Profiles, including archives of past shows, can be found on our website at wfiu.org. Profiles is a production of WFIU and comes from the studios at Indiana University. Christina Kuzmich, executive producer. Please join us again for the next edition of Profiles. For WFIU, thanks for listening.